That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I walk a straight line, shackle and chain. Oh, gruesome Gertie is calling my name. There is no mercy in this penitentiary. Just ask the Hill String Gang, Rango the Three.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to another edition of Bloody
Angola,
a podcast 142 years in the making.
Complete story of America's bloodiest prison.
And I'm Jim Chapman.
And I'm Woody Overton, and we're back in the saddle together again.
At the same time, right? we're doing an episode.
Together, and I also want to say that this, I don't know if it's the first episode, but Bloody Angola is now hosted solely by Envision Podcast,
right?
Studios,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And that's a change, but it's not going to affect y'all. You're still, you know, on the same feed and get your downloads.
That's right.
You subscribe, but also encourage other people to subscribe. And Patreon members,
yes,
we love and appreciate y'all. And you just got another episode,
yeah,
a bonus episode. And if you want to be a Patreon member or are curious about it, go to patreon.com/bloodyangola.
Right. Yeah, and you'll be able to get all kinds of neat stuff. So we're going to jump into today's episode. And look, as important as the history of Bloody Angola is, the inmates that are housed inside of Angola make up a lot of that history as well. Right. 18,000 plus acres of Louisiana's notorious prison. And in the past, we've told you about several of these inhabitants, I guess you could say, Leadbelly, yep, to C. Murder, yep, to Wilbert Rideau, yep, to many others. And today we're going to cover a guy that is not only in all likelihood the most notorious rapist in Angola's history, but also the man who spurred what was the start of the FBI's profiling task force.
Yep, yep.
He was kind of the main reason this came together. Yep. So
the FBI is not only the nation's leading law enforcement agency, and they're in charge of federal crimes, but they also have, and this is what started on this, but they're in charge of studying crime and trying to predict crime and things like that, right?
Right.
But we're going to talk about a guy named John Simonis, and yep, he is known as the Ski Mask Rapist, and he confessed to 81 rapes nationwide and has been linked to over 130 attacks in a 12-state crime spree, which occurred primarily between 1978 and when he was finally captured in 1981.
And that's a lot short time period.
And he probably did more, right? But wow. But he started out, you know, the way rapists typically start out, which is, this is going back to the profile, which we'll get into. But he was a peeping Tom. He peeped in the windows. And, y'all, when they do that, they do that and they masturbate to it. When the masturbation doesn't cover it anymore, and he progressed to rape, and y'all, the next logical progression from that is to murder the victim so they can't tell. But, thank God they caught him when he did, because he didn't commit any murders.
No doubt. Now, at that time, police in cities all over the country, they were going crazy trying to solve all these rape cases that they seemed to be connected somehow, but they couldn't exactly figure out. They couldn't get any sort of bead on where this guy was, but they could tell that the descriptions from the people he would rape matched too closely to be two different people.
Certain.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, certain aspects of the crime, right?
Yeah.
The modus operandi.
That's right. And because the rapes crossed state lines, the FBI eventually got involved, but they just couldn't seem to catch him.
Right. And so the FBI put together a profile of this guy, Simonis, and here's what they knew as fact from his previous rapes. He only entered the homes between 8 p.m. and 1 a.m., and he starts off attempting to comfort those he rapes. Right?
Yeah.
And y'all, that's
yeah,
a certain place.
I'm not going to hurt
I'm
you.
I'm not going to hurt you. Just let me do what I want to do. And it's going to be okay as long as you do what I say, right?
Yep.
And also, he was over 6 feet tall with a slender frame, dark hair, and he was always armed with a knife or a gun. Then he always tied up his victims and rapes them in full view of any males in the house, sometimes taunting the men as he does it, right? That's kind of unusual. Also, he would leave the victims tied up while robbing the houses of anything like TVs or anything of value.
Yeah. So the FBI is looking into this pretty hard. This guy, even at this time, had already been linked to, 30-something crimes, mm-hmm, or rapes. And there's a profiler who is probably one of the most popular in history, a lady by the name of Ann Burgess. And this young profiler goes up to her and he says, look, I need your help on some cases. And she says, well, tell me about it. And he took 15 cases. And he said, I want to look at the progression of these. So the first 5 cases, this guy was a run-of-the-mill rapist, right? He surprised single women in a house. He would bind them with their own clothing, and he would vaginally rape them. Then they looked at the middle 5 cases, and they saw that he started using handcuffs all of a sudden. He would force anal and oral penetration, sometimes even in front of other family members. And sometimes he would rape more than one woman during the same attack.
Right. Whoever was there.
That's right. And then his last 5 cases that they knew he was involved in, there was even a higher level of progression And the aggression also increased with that. So, for example, he punched a woman in the breast repeatedly while taunting her husband. They were both tied up. And so, you know, Am was kind of asked, why does he continue to progress like that? And basically, her thought process was he seemed to be seeking the same thrill that he got from those first five victims. Right. It's just like if you're a drug addict, you're always chasing that first high. Yeah, that's right. The first person he ever raped was, in his mind, the hottest, if you will. And he's always kind of chasing that. And he has to get more and more evil to do that, to get that same high. So that was one thing. And so the young profiler basically said, well, the motive doesn't change, even though the violence does. Right. And she said, well, the reason for that is it's all about the control he gets from the rape. Yeah. He's really wanting control. Mm-hmm. The control is what gets him off.
Right.
And so then that young profiler asked, why does he progress to forcing male parties to watch, making the husbands watch the rape of the wife? And she said, that is about power. It's the control aspect with a lot of humiliation mixed in. The need for an audience also suggested to her that there was a history of trauma in the perpetrator's past. She hypothesized that the perpetrator is reliving an experience of his past and just flipped it where he is the one in control rather than being the one out of control. Right. So she's suspecting maybe he was raped somewhere in his past, and it's important for him to ensure others witness him being in control.
Right, right. Yeah. So, and what do? They come up with a profile, right? And again, I told y'all the FBI is in charge of studying crime and stuff like that. And they started this, and I'm sure we'll get into it, but they started studying it, and they were able to break down rapists and murders and everything, pedophiles, into different categories. But usually in the cases that I've dealt with, like 90% of everything in the profile is spot on.
Yeah.
But the FBI final profile for this asshole said he was a male in late 20s to early 30s, never been married, has domineering behavior, and which reflected a level of confidence. He sees himself as an alpha male, right? And he's a very detailed individual, such as discreetly cutting phone wires before entering a home. I mean, he wasn't sloppy. It wasn't just a crime opportunity for him. He had certain things that he followed, right? And he also was a perfectionist and in good physical shape, likely played sports. He had a clean appearance and he had a tendency to reflect his confidence in the way that he carried himself. And he likely had a flashy car. And his ability to move throughout the U.S. and commit his crimes indicate he likely served in the military and is used to adapting to areas he has never been in. And his increased aggression showed he was starting to enjoy hurting his victims and would likely murder soon.
Yeah, that progression was really concerning them at that time. Right. But like all criminals, Simonis's luck was about to run out. Mm-hmm. In October of 1981 in Gonzales, Louisiana.
Right up the street from us.
That's right. An officer noticed a lipstick red Pontiac Trans Am.
Flashy car.
Now, back in those days in Gonzales, Louisiana, y'all, you didn't really see a whole lot of Pontiac Trans Ams. Right, it was a small working community. Yeah. There was hardly anything there. So while, you know, this police officer didn't stop the person or anything, he probably thought, wow, that's a nice car.
It's like the Smokey and Abandoned Trans Ams we're talking about.
Yeah. That's right. So that same night, police received a phone call about a ski mask gunman confronting three women at the home of one of the women. One at a time, this man raped each victim while the other two were bound and forced to watch. Mm-hmm. He robbed the victims and stole one of the girls' vehicles before speeding off after the rapes. So that officer, he picks this up. He's got his scanner. He's at home at the time. And he hears this. And he's like, man, if for whatever reason, he flashes back to that Trans Am.
Right.
And on a hunch, he says, I'm gonna drive and see if that Trans Am's still parked in that area. So on a hunch, he returns to the scene where that Trans Am was earlier that day, and he doesn't see the car. He doesn't see the Trans Am, but he does see the stolen car was parked in the place where the Trans Am was. Mm-hmm. The officer also finds a discarded set of gloves right outside the vehicle. So light bulb goes off, police issue a bolo for that Trans Am, and eventually it was seen, and they got a plate number. When they ran that plate number, they find that the car is registered to 31-year-old John Barry Simonis. So eventually Simonis gets arrested in Lake Charles, Louisiana, and this is a week after Thanksgiving in 1981 outside of a grocery store. And eventually it was discovered he had carried out those 81 rapes across 12 states. So after he was caught, you might be wondering, how accurate was that FBI profile? Mm-hmm. So we compared that to the facts on Simonis. Simonis was an all-state quarterback in high school.
There's the athlete.
Had served in the Army from 1973 to 1977.
Military history.
He also had an advanced IQ of 128.
Which proves that he was smart and thought out his crimes.
Maintained an athletic build.
Spot on.
He witnessed his father have sex with his sister when he was a child.
That might come to voyeurism, yep.
And he was very confident, almost cocky. Right. He was proud of his rapes. He actually got mad at a fellow inmate at one point while he was in prison for confessing to a rape that he committed.
Wow.
Yeah, so he was proud of this shit.
Yeah, right. And don't take credit for mine.
Yeah. Yeah, how dare you?
You can't do that.
I did that.
Yeah, y'all got to remember that back then there was no internet and all that, and the newspaper was where you got your news. But this article was written by Bill Crider, and it's with Associated Press. It says, New Orleans, the man called a ski mask rapist, who says his three-year terror spree included 81 crimes in 12 states, is now in his permanent residence at Angola Prison. He's facing 21 life sentences plus 2,681 years in jail. During each of six court appearances since early December, John Barry Simonis said he was sorry about everything but couldn't help himself. I am guilty of these crimes. I knew extremely well what I was doing beforehand while I was doing it, and I know now, Simonis told District Judge Charles Becknell during the December 10th hearing in Donaldsonville. Simonis, who turns 31 Friday, said he would wear a ski mask during break-ins and often rape women residents who happened to be home. He received his 21 life sentences on rape convictions, the extra years for other crimes, including armed robbery, burglary, and auto theft. Simonis began his prison term Sunday. Simonis was arrested on November 27th in Lake Charles, his hometown, and officers had been told that a car like Simonis's was seen near a scene of one of the ski mask rapist attacks. Simonis was placed under surveillance and was taken into custody as he left a store near his home. It was then that he told investigators about 81 armed robberies or burglaries in 30 cities in 12 states, many of them involving rape or other sexual crimes. Other men had been convicted in two of the crimes described by Simonis. And in Texas, one man was quickly freed, but there was some confusion because the rape victim insisted she was not convinced Simonis was the man who attacked her. Everything Simonis knew could have come from newspapers. Anybody who attended the trial or anyone who investigated the case, she said. However, Clarence Vaughn Williams, serving 50 years on the rape conviction, was released on December the 5th at a special court session in Orange, Texas, on a motion filed by both the defense and the prosecution. Simonis knew too many details not to have committed the rape, said Orange County District Attorney Jim Jenkins. In Athens County, Ohio, a 22-year-old man apparently will be cleared of a rape and robbery conviction because the victim identified Simonis as her assailant, Prosecutor Michael Ward said earlier this week. Now, two other rape robbery convictions continue in nearby Fairfield County against Braylee C. Cox of Lancaster, Ohio. But Simonis has also confessed to them. In addition, queries about Simonis have been received from law enforcement officials in California, Florida, Georgia, Indiana, Michigan, Mississippi, North Carolina, Oklahoma, and Wisconsin, state police in Louisiana say. The string of prison terms imposed by Louisiana's courts was the full extent of what the law could do to Simonis in that state. Only first-degree murder carries a death penalty. He would be a candidate for Frine, I guarantee it. But unfortunately, under a law which was changed by the U.S. Supreme Court, the death penalty no longer applies on these crimes, Jefferson Davis Parish District Attorney Greg Arnett said after Simonis' 21st life sentence was announced. In Louisiana, a life sentence without parole really does mean life. Only a governor's pardon can cancel it. Authorities here say Simonis' stiff sentences in Louisiana make it unlikely that other states will seek to try him. We think John Simonis is going to spend the rest of his days in Louisiana, said State Police Lieutenant Ronnie Jones. Simonis, who worked as an attendant in a cardiology unit at a Lake Charles hospital, was first arrested in January of 1978 for making obscene phone calls to women. He was convicted but received a suspended sentence after agreeing to receive psychiatric help. Now, the ski mask crimes occurred after that arrest. Harvey Hunsinger, his former probation officer, said Simonis impressed me as the Boy Scout type. He was neat, clean-cut, punctual, didn't change his residence. He was well thought of at work, and he was open to me in discussing his problems. Simonis underwent a required 3-day series of mental and physical tests at the Hunt Correctional Institution in St. Gabriel before being transferred to Angola. He is considered an escape risk, said Edie Day, a spokeswoman for the Department of Corrections. He will spend an indefinite period in extended lockdown, remaining in a one-man tier above death row instead of being placed within the general population. Simonis has said that he plans to spend his time in prison writing books on how people can avoid becoming victims of criminals like himself.
There you go.
That's a hell of an article.
Yeah, and, you know, people were getting released that were in jail for crimes that he actually committed.
Rapes and robberies and everything else.
No doubt about that. So it's off to Angola for John Simonis.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And in 1985, an FBI profiler by the basically met with Simonis at Louisiana State Penitentiary. And while prepping, you know, that profiler, he starts thinking about what is the best way to approach the interview. Now, and I'll go over these, and Woody's familiar with these, obviously, right. But you. One of those ways is known as the Reed technique.
Mm-hmm. It's Chicago. A detective turned lawyer who developed that program.
There you go. And what the Reed technique does is it strives to break down the suspect's resistance to confess. It, you want to make the suspect comfortable. It's a psychological trick. Give me an example of that, Woody. How are you going to make me uncomfortable?
The funny thing is, I was doing this before they sent me to the school.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy shit, this is everything I do when they sent me to the school.
It should be the Overton technique.
You're going to go in there and you can be, first of all, non-judgmental.
Yeah.
You want to take the person off the defensive and be like, hey, man, I'm just, here doing my job. And, I'm not saying anything one way or another. I certainly don't think you're a bad person and shit like that. You got to break down that I'm a cop. You're going to prison for the rest of your life. I need you to give me the juice.
Yeah, I mean, I know she was just 16, but I mean, she's hot, right, man. She's hot.
I've used that so many times. Look, that she got titties like you.
Yeah.
They didn't grow like that when we were coming up. Anything, y'all, and it's disgusting.
Right.
So, and some you have to be submissive to, some you have to be a little domineering to. You had to figure that person out and figure out what made them click to relate to you.
And there's also what's known as the cognitive approach, which is using open-ended questions.
Right.
Instead, so get them talking instead of just being able to say no.
Absolutely. And y'all actually, you want to cut off any of their denials and reform it and leave it as an open-ended question. And a lot of them have diarrhea of the mouth. They want to talk.
They want to show you
how smart they are, and that's where they hang themselves.
And then there's also what's known as the kinesic method, which involves reading an individual's body language movements and facial expressions to determine if they're being truthful.
Yep. And I was doing that again before I knew it was a thing.
Yeah. So you may ask yourself, well, what if they want to talk like Simonis did and like Woody just said, some do want to do, they'll tell you whatever you want to know. And that situation, the questions would be more deliberate in tone. Think of it like an interview from a news station, just very direct questions with no deviation in the tone of the questions. So we actually have a transcript from the interview that was done by this FBI profiler in 1985. And y'all get ready to listen because this is going to really open your eyes to who this guy was. The FBI profiler was a guy by the name of Roy Hazelwood. And Woody is going to be playing the part of Roy Hazelwood.
I actually read one of Roy Hazelwood's books on profiling.
Oh, very cool. And I'm going to be playing the part of John Simonis, the rapist. So this is going to be interesting, and really what he says in here, a lot of this will shock
right.
you.
Right. So remember, I'm Hazelwood. I'm the FBI profiler. So I say, what were you incarcerated for?
A series of armed robberies and rapes.
What is the total number of those combined?
Between 45 and 50 rapes. Actual sexual assaults probably would get higher, anywhere between 60 and 75.
Mm. And what would you include in sexual assaults?
Well, somebody who performs oral sex, masturbation, any kind of sexual act other than intercourse. Mm.
And what states did these take place, and what period of time are we talking about?
Well, my first assault took place in November of 1978, and it ended in November of 1981. It went from Florida to Georgia, North Carolina, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas, Oklahoma, and California.
Hmm. Would you say there was a progression or an escalation or aggression or violence associated with your attacks?
Oh, yes. It started out very mild, but it progressed quite heavily.
Describe your first assault.
The first one started out to be a burglary. I entered a home, and I was confronted by a lady who lived there, who I'd followed from a shopping center earlier that day. After confronting the woman, I kind of let her know that I was in control. After I got the money from her and I kind of bound her hands, I took her into the bedroom and had her perform masturbation on me. I was unable to do vaginal intercourse because I was unable to get an erection at that time. I was very nervous.
You did not physically assault her?
No, sir.
You progressed in your violence near the end, though? Why?
Well, near the end of my criminal activities, it got to be a much more violent thing, a form of degradation towards the women, making them feel dominated. My intention was to inflict fear on them, to make them do things they would never ordinarily do.
Did your preparation for your crimes evolve as well?
I progressed in a much more disguised way. My face was covered. I wore gloves. I also wore baggy clothes, like coveralls, to kind of conceal my build. I also took into the place a pistol with pre-cut lengths of rope to bind those victims with, or handcuffs, duct tape to blind them, maybe tape their mouths, and even a pocket knife in case I needed to cut anything.
What precautions did you take when you left?
I'd usually just cut the phone lines, make sure they were tied securely where they could not get loose anytime soon. Sometimes I'd slash their tires to prevent them from traveling.
How much money did you make from your thefts?
After fencing the stuff, about $250,000. Retail it probably was worth $3-4 million.
Was it necessary for you to work as well?
Not at all. When I worked in the hospital as a cardiovascular specialist, I was making somewhere from $14,000 to $18,000 a year. I'd make that much sometimes in 1 month from my thefts.
How did you identify your victims?
There were different ways. They were usually wealthy. As I drove through an area, I'd pick out a house and look to belong to a financially secure couple. Sometimes I'd pick somebody driving around in an expensive car, or I might see somebody inside a store who might be wearing a gold watch or a large diamond. I'd wait outside in my car and then follow them to where they lived. If I didn't hit them directly, I'd probably hit somebody else in the neighborhood where they lived.
Well, what about the women attracted you?
Attractive ones had an appealing effect on me. It wasn't always the motive for following them, but it was a major one. I figured that if a woman was attractive and her husband was well off, he'd do things to keep her happy, buy her expensive jewelry or other nice things. There was an initial reason for a lot of the attacks. I'd rob or take what I could. The assaults and rapes usually took place afterward.
Why do you think you did these things?
Oh, it's pretty complex. I think there were a multitude of things involved. Money was a motive. Sex was a factor. Urges just came on to me at a point that I was unable to control them near the end. The effects on me when I saw a woman had more of a hold on me than I had on them.
Did the robberies and burglaries and entering homes satisfy some of your urges?
It got me high just going into a place that belonged to somebody else. Any kind of illegal activity, knowing there was a risk of being caught, that created stimulation. It was a turn on, so to speak, but it was a different high than a sexual aspect. That kind of coincided with one another.
You began deviant sexual behavior at 15, is that right? With window peeping?
Yes.
How long did you continue to window peep?
Oh, off and on until the times I was actually going into the houses.
You stopped at that time?
Well, I classify window peeping as just looking and not doing anything else. There were lots of times I'd peek in a window and see a woman who might be undressed, but it was more to get an idea of who was at home and where they were at. It wasn't just looking and leaving.
What about the exhibitionism?
Well, that started when I was in Europe in the army. I was 24.
How long did that go on for?
Off and on for about 3 years.
Was the purpose to get a response from the women?
Exactly. Oh. A lot of times I got a stimulating feeling just from the reaction of people. A lot of times it was to induce fear or surprise and see how they responded to it. I would feed off of this fear. It was like a source of fuel for me.
But What about the obscene phone calls you were arrested for? When did that start?
That was around 77 or 78, somewhere around there.
And you've said in the past to police that you masturbated way more than average, than the average person. What kind of fantasies did you have during the masturbating?
It was a multitude of things. It might consist of bondage or the fantasy of rape or maybe multiple males or multiple females.
How often would you masturbate?
Sometimes 4 or 5 times a day. But there were times when it was as much as 10 to 12 times.
During the time you were committing your rapes, were you also having consenting sexual relations?
Yes, quite a bit.
Did you ever live with a woman?
Several of them, yes.
Why do you think you were so successful for such a long period of time?
I think it was just a natural instinct I developed, and I relied on it heavily. It always paid off for me. It got to be a cat and mouse game with the police. I knew they were after me by 1980. From there, I figured if I kept on going, I could just not create a definite pattern. I had to stagger my attacks and my robberies in different states, always change my clothing, have new stuff after every job, throw the old stuff away, never keep any evidence. I tried to think like the cops would think. For example, after I left one job, I figured they probably blocked the interstates, so I used back roads. It was kind of a guessing game with them.
Was traveling a lot of jurisdictions part of these efforts?
Oh, yes. Spreading them out. There was less of a chance of people associating those crimes with me.
Did you ever use your occupation to select victims?
Oh, yes. When I worked in a hospital, I had access to all the medical records. I knew where the patients lived, what their husbands did, whether he worked in town or out of town, who was home during the day and who wasn't. Also, if they were having surgery, I'd have access to their keys, which they usually left on their nightstands by their bed. I'd go down and have a copy made and return the original and copy down to their address, and later I would use that copy to get in their house.
Did you ever take advantage of patients under sedation?
Oh, sometimes. I had neurology patients we had to sometimes sedate, so there were times for that, yeah.
What was the youngest victim you sexually assaulted?
Age-wise, I don't really know. About maybe 13, 14.
And the oldest victim?
There was one in Houston who was 50. But she was real well preserved. She looked more like 38 or 40.
You mentioned that you would take things that were easily transportable, easily concealed. Why?
Well, in the beginning, I took a lot of things like televisions and video recorders, but I was exposing myself to the chance of being caught. Later on, I started just taking jewelry, easy to conceal and lightweight. It didn't bog me down in case I had to move or run or get away quickly.
What kind of vehicle did you drive?
Well, I started off driving a 78 Buick Regal. It was gray, and I had it painted black. I also had a 79 Kawasaki motorcycle that I used especially out in the country where I could conceal it quite well. But later on, I sold that Buick and that bike, and I bought an 81 red Trans Am.
Did you like to drive?
Yes. I put about 80,000 miles on that thing in 10 months.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
Complete your staining project with Pittsburgh Paints and Stains, now at Menards. Stain in one coat with Ultra Advanced Semi-Transparent Stain. It's a stain and sealant in one that can be applied to damp wood and on hot, sunny days, allowing you to clean and stain your deck in one day. Save big money on Pittsburgh Paints and Stains and head into Menards to get your staining project started today.
Save big money.
why did you like to drive so much?
I just liked to travel. It gave me a sense of freedom. I didn't have to worry about what I did. I didn't have to worry about answering to people. Mm.
You indicated earlier that you had these tremendous urges that kind of drove you. Yet in some cases, you'd rob and burglarize and not sexually assault. What are some of the factors that determine whether or not you sexually assaulted a victim?
Well, the victim herself plays a part in that. If they show fear, apprehension, sometimes I'd feed off of that. That might cause me to make a sexual attack. Sometimes I had no sexual contact at all. I don't know why.
Were there ever practical reasons why you wouldn't sexually assault?
Well, sometimes if the assault jeopardized getting away with the robbery, I wouldn't do it.
Did you ever take anything that wasn't valuable?
Just some articles of clothing, maybe a driver's license on a few occasions. They were just temporary things, you know, to hang on to.
And what did they represent to you?
Like a trophy, kind of a reminder. It helped me visualize in my mind when I reenacted the fantasy in my head.
You said you dressed in a particular way for your assaults. What would you do with that material later?
Oh, I'd always discard it, put it in dumpsters, rip it up, and throw it out the window along the interstate. Usually this was a long distance away. I'd never dump it right there in the community where I committed the crime.
What would be your first response when a woman resisted you?
In the early stages, if they would have put up a scream, it would have probably dissuaded me from sticking around.
Well, what would happen later on?
It would have been a point of agitation to me, and I probably would have retaliated by taking a physical action against them.
Such as?
Beating them, kicking them, or burning them. Any way to inflict pain to get them to be quiet.
Describe the assaults.
Well, their hands were tied, and usually their feet were too, but not always. I'd slam my fist into their breast or into their stomachs. Sometimes I would hit them across the face. There were times I'd light a cigarette and touch it to their breast.
What about the police officer's wife? She said you were a gentleman, and then you assaulted her.
Correct. I struck her across the mouth a couple of times.
What was the reason for that?
I felt she was trying to patronize me, like she was talking down to me, treating me like a child. It irritated me. It agitated me. I decided to let her know I was in control, and she would not dictate to me what was going on.
You mentioned compulsive urges just a moment ago, yet you're able to control the urges so as not to bring harm to yourself. If you had an urge to assault, but you knew the area to be dangerous, what would you do?
My safety came first. If I thought I could pull it off, I would pull it off. If I thought I couldn't, I'd go somewhere else or try from a different angle.
So you did not have an irresistible impulse?
No, not total domination. Later on, it did get to where it controlled me a lot more than I wanted it to, but I wasn't at its control completely.
I'd like to talk a little bit about pornography. Did you ever view or collect it?
Yes, I had a small binder full of different pictures I'd get from Playboy and other skin books.
How did you use these pictures?
I looked at them for masturbation.
Did you ever view pornography when you were younger?
Yes, I did, but I did not get off on it. I was about 6 or 7, I think, the first time I actually came in contact with any kind of pornography. It was something like Stag. From my earliest memory, sex was connected to violence and pain in my imagination. I remember one picture. It had an artist's conception of a woman completely nude with her hands tied together and bound above her head, tied to a rope that went up to a ceiling. And there was a man standing up there with a smile on his face holding a large knife. It looked like he was getting ready to inflict bodily harm, a form of mutilation almost. It wasn't so much the nude woman that excited me. It was the overall picture.
Hmm. Do you think the picture had an impact on you?
I think it did. It stayed in my subconscious all these years. I'm not saying it was a contributing factor for me to do the things I did. I have to take full blame for that, but I do think it contributed in some way.
A while back, we were talking about sexual bondage, and you mentioned tying your victims in a variety of different positions. Where'd you get that idea from?
From a magazine.
Was it your goal to inflict pain on your victims?
Well, yes. That was the most stimulating part, I guess, to inflict pain and terror into a woman. The attacker kind of feeds off it. It's kind of like adding fuel to the body. The more you see it, the more it stimulates you, the more it gets a person going.
Is it the pain itself, the goal, or is the victim's response?
I think it's the initial response that they give off that's produced by their pain. That is what the sadistic person is actually looking for. It's not that he doesn't enjoy inflicting that pain, but the final product is the reaction you get from it. If you inflicted pain and they showed no response whatsoever, it would be like making sex to a dead person. You get no thrill out of that.
What was the turn on? Was it sexual intercourse or control?
Oh, it was a multitude of things. The race were a sexual thing a lot of the time, but it was also mainly the idea of being dominant, having complete control, having the woman at your disposal and mercy to do what you wanted to do. I'm glad, in a way, that it stopped when it did. Rape was... Well, it was beginning to bore me. At the time I was arrested outside that Lake Charles convenience store, my fantasies increasingly were of murder.
Well, thanks for agreeing to this interview. Our time is up.
And there you have it.
Yeah, see, I can tell you what Hazelwood, you know, he's probably heard a thousand stories like this, but even as a whole hardened cop, when you're almost getting off on not on the details, but you're getting off on the fact that you got this motherfucker bragging about his shit. So what you're going to, and they take that back and they study and they classify it and put it in into those profiles. And so when they started this, they did it like, I think it was like 81, whenever it was, they came to realize they were having more prolific problem with serial killers. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think there were any more serial killers 5 years before when they realized this, but what happened was you had cable television came out for the first time.
Yeah.
So you had your first CNN and, you know, 24-hour news and stuff like that, and they can only report on the price of eggs in China for so long, and nothing sells like sex and murder and whatever. So they started picking up these murder cases.
Yeah.
And then it became more reported. Look how it is today on social media. It's instant. Everybody gets it. But so that's why they started. They started studying it, and they realized, holy fuck, we got something in here. But they went into these prisons, and they gave immunity to anything that you say. Either it was people like Simonis who were fully convicted or whatever,
yeah.
But they would also say, you know what, you're already doing however many life sentences, you help us out, and they might have got some extra canteen or whatever the fuck, but they got them to agree to it.
Yeah.
And all the great ones, and people like some, I say great ones, great true murderers and rapists like
right.
this. So when they did it for murder and they were so successful in the profiling of murders, they went back and they did it for every major crime. The very next one they did it for was rape or sexual crimes.
Yeah.
And that's where this came from. And now they have it for everything. But these guys love to talk about themselves.
Oh, yeah.
The smart ones, the preferentials. Now, the situational rapist who's just is one that snatches a lady who's running down the street, doesn't think out their crimes or whatever, not high intelligence, and they're not really even interested in talking to these motherfuckers. They want to talk to the monsters like this.
That's right. And that guy right there, 128 IQ, and you can tell just in the interview, he was extremely smart. He's cutting up clothes and throwing them out windows. Never would I throw those out in the community I committed the rape in. You know, those are things a normal rapist don't think of.
Never hesitated in giving an answer, a truthful answer, and he knows what he is. And he got off on being interviewed about it. Ha ha, I was so smart. I did it over 80 times and got away with it. And if he's and got to listen to this episode of Bloody Angola, he'd get off on it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he'd love that. Well, we thank y'all for listening. Yes. And just wanted to bring you something on
that's,
one of these.
That's great. Hardcore. Right there. That's
yeah.
That was a great episode.
Yeah, that 81 confessed to and over 150 linked.
Think about how many people he peeping Tom. And
oh, my gosh.
And actually, they showed that they go from peeping Tom to, like, stealing, breaking in and stealing panties. Then when that fantasy doesn't do enough, they actually commit the first rape.
Yep.
But, yeah, they – I believe 1,000% he was headed on the road for murder.
No doubt about it. So, and he even said that, yeah, admittedly. Yeah. You know, well, so
they got him in time, and thankfully, he's going to die in Bloody Angola.
That's right. And until next time, I'm Jim Chapman.
And I'm Woody Everton.
Your host of Bloody
Angola,
a podcast 142 years in the making.
A complete story of America's bloodiest prison.
Peace.
I walk a straight line, shackle and chain. Oh, gruesome Gertie is calling my name. There is no mercy in this penitentiary. Just ask the Hillstring Gang, Wrangler 3.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.